We are winding down our summer schedule here, both in the Aphorisms on Karma and in the Bhagavad Gita. So the cycle ends next week, but there'll be a new cycle beginning for the, I guess it's the fall, winter, spring session. Though we usually say winter. So just stay tuned. The United Lodge of Theosophists is an association of students. It's not an organization. We don't have bylaws or a constitution, but rather it's similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. So that's what binds us together is the teachings, and we are here to spread broadcast those teachings to the best of our ability. No one here is a teacher. The teachers were on the scene, and they left voluminous writings for us to dwell on for incarnations to come, no doubt. So we do not, you know, we welcome everyone, period, really. We welcome everyone, period. Just come as you are. You know, there was a time when, you know, race, creed, condition, whatever was perhaps more of a groundbreaking thing. But it's in a metropolitan city, it's pretty much understood, we should say. So Theosophy is a philosophy, and we do have fundamental principles. And we are loyal to the great founders. And we should remember that the true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So in order to spread broadcast the teachings, we are open on a regular cyclical basis. On Wednesday evenings, the door opens at 5:15. There is a reference library with a librarian there if you should have any questions, or you can do any self-directed study that you like, in comparative religious studies or philosophy, or, you know, there's books in science and math there too if you want to peruse them. It is not a lending library, but a reference library. So that is open, and you, of course, there's always there's a reference there for the evening's part. So if you want to read the part before class and the reference before class, then you're certainly welcome to come during those hours. The book table is open from, I guess, around 6:30-ish until right before the meeting and right after the meeting. And there we have a straight line, theosophical literature, books, pamphlets, pretty much just all online now too, if you prefer. We're not trying to make a profit. We never did make a profit on books. They're sold strictly at cost. So on Sunday mornings, we're getting near the end of the Bhagavad Gita on Wednesday nights. But on Sunday mornings, we've been studying the aphorisms on reincarnation and karma, aphorisms on karma. And today, there's five aphorisms, 24 through 28, we believe. And they are, there should be a handout if you didn't get one yet. So the meeting, the lodge opens at 10:30 on Sundays. Meeting begins promptly at 11, ends promptly at 12. All of our activities at the lodge are voluntary contributions of time, money, and service. Nothing is imposed or implied. We don't pass the basket, but all contributions are gratefully accepted and can be made at the book table, or there's a little box on top of the barrister cases on the right-hand side as you're exiting. So, at this time, we have a volunteer student who will summarize the aphorisms for today.
We want to just refer back to two of the aphorisms from last week because the ones that we're looking at today build on those. And aphorism 22 talked about karma is of three sorts. That which is presently operative in this life, that which is being made or stored up to be exhausted in the future, and the third one is karma that is held over from past life or lives and not yet operating. And then aphorism number 23, the three fields of operation of karma, the body and the circumstances, the mind and intellect, and the last plane is that of psychic and astral. So what we were thinking of doing was reading each aphorism and then going back and summarizing each one. So number 24 is held over karma or present karma may each or both at once operate in all of the three fields of karmic operation at once, or in either of those fields, a different class of karma from that using the others may operate at the same time. 25, birth into any sort of body and to obtain the fruits of any sort of karma is due to the preponderance of the line of karmic tendency. 26, the sway of karmic tendency will influence the incarnation of an ego or any family of egos for three lives at least, when measures of repression, elimination, or counteraction are not adopted. 27, measures taken by an ego to repress tendency eliminate defects and to counteract by setting up different causes will alter the sway of karmic tendency and shorten its influence in accordance with the strength or weakness of the efforts expended in carrying out the measures adopted. And 28, no man but a sage or true seer can judge another's karma. Hence, while each receives his deserts, appearances may deceive, and birth into poverty or heavy trial may not be punishment for bad karma, for egos continually incarnate into poor surroundings where they experience difficulties and trials which are for the discipline of the ego and result in strength, fortitude, and sympathy. So there's a lot in these five. So the first one, birth into any sort of body and to obtain the fruits of any sort of karma is due to the preponderance of the line of karmic tendency. Mainly what this is saying is that when a soul comes into manifestation, that form that they are using is dictated by karma depending upon the lesson that that soul has to learn. So there's an impression, there's a magnetic pull to that particular lifetime that it doesn't, and it's not necessarily dependent upon what happened in the previous life. Karma is not linear. What I do now will determine what happens in the next life. It doesn't work like that. What we are experiencing now could be those effects from lifetimes you know, 15, 20, 100 lives before. So we can't say, well, you know, he's got that karma coming to him because he did this and this in his last life. That's not the way it works. It's dependent upon everything that this person has done in the past. 26. The sway of karmic tendency will influence the incarnation of an ego or family of egos for three lives at least when measures of repression, elimination, or counteraction are not adopted. So what we think this aphorism is saying is that not only the ego in this particular manifestation, but he's also talking about a family of egos. I mean, it could mean the family that person is born into. It could be that sphere of friends that person is born into. And that it says the sway will be for three lives at least. So the lesson that person has to learn, or that family has to learn, if that free will is not exercised to counteract whatever is coming to them, if they are not doing the duties that are coming to them, then for at least three lives, they will suffer with whatever negative karma will be coming to them unless they do something about it in this life. So 27. Measures taken by an ego to repress tendency, eliminate defects, and to counteract by setting up different causes will alter the sway of karmic tendency and shorten its influence in accordance with the strength or weakness of the efforts expended in carrying out the measures adopted. So we're mainly speaking about what occurred in 26, measures taken by the ego. So in other words, again, if a person or family doesn't take those corrections in this life, then they will continue to have these issues for three more lives. So it's important to set up. So by setting up different causes means that you have worked on correcting the issues that you're experiencing now and doing your duty when it comes to you, not saying, oh, I don't feel like doing that, but doing it anyway, whatever comes to you. And 28, no man but a sage or true seer can judge another's karma. Hence, while each receives his deserts, appearances may deceive, and birth into poverty or heavy trial may not be punishment for bad karma, for egos continually incarnate in the poor surroundings where they experience difficulties and trials, which are for the discipline of the ego and result in strength, fortitude, and sympathy. So, sometimes we see these awful conditions that some people are born into, and what this aphorism we think is saying is that it doesn't necessarily mean that life experience for that particular ego in that life is as the result of something that they had done in a past life. Sometimes that ego chooses to experience a certain incarnation for his own lessons that he feels as though he needs, as he put it, result in strength, fortitude, and sympathy. Also, that particular ego might be choosing that particular life in order for, when we talked about the ego, family of egos, might be because he is sacrificing for the good of the family that he is being born into. Did we cover all family?
Thank you. So, we are warned again and again, not only in the aphorisms, but throughout the philosophy of, you know, do not judge others. And it's funny, it's like, in a sense, we can't help judging others, but we can't make a judgment because we don't know the source. Just like the iceberg is, what, 10% on the surface and 90% below. Well, if we're lucky, we can see 10%. And even if we can, it's a very hazy picture. So, with that, we'll... Yes, in the back?
Well, it's just you said we can't help judging others. My grandmother always used to say, if you can't see anything nice about somebody else, you're not looking hard enough.
That's good. Wise woman. Yes?
So partially related to 25 and 26, the statement was made that karma is not linear, but any particular event in one life could potentially be a result of karma enacted a number of many lives ago. But it would seem from 26 that to a certain extent it is linear, because the karma of the soul that brings it into a specific birth with a specific body, with specific parents, and specific heredity, is related to a line of karmic tendency that's followed directly for at least three lives, maybe more. So there would seem to be a certain linear aspect.
Well, that's true. And just like the Earth was at once thought to be flat because it appears to be linear, to anyone standing at any point, pretty much, maybe on a mountaintop, who knows, you could see perhaps the horizon curving. But there is a line, there are family lines, there's nation lines, there's, you know, there's all kinds of lines of karma. And one of the examples given in the Ocean of Theosophy is that... what was it? Was it Beethoven, that he was this great genius?
Bach.
Okay. Well, they were all geniuses. And eventually it dies out. That talent dies out. The son or the grandson or granddaughter can have, you know, there's like a flowering, and then there's a withering, and then there's seeds spread broadcast on the ground. And that could be picked up by another line. But yes, it does appear linear, but everything goes in cycles. And, you know, there are many, many cycles. Follow up? Or?
Just to follow up on the last point, I think a good example of the cyclical nature of the karma is that statement in the Ocean of Theosophy that the karma of the egos in Atlantis has not yet been fully experienced. And it'd be ages before we fully experience the results of that karma, even though some of it is being experienced now as egos from those previous civilizations are now incarnated in the West.
Right, so we have much more in store. There was someone in the back there, their hand up? Ann Sullivan.
Yeah. And then so much that she has done for, quote, humanity as an adult, that there was a complete change in that personality.
Well, there was a change in both personalities because It was a challenge for the teacher that she, you know, can you imagine being put into that situation as a teacher? Someone who is deaf, dumb, and blind. I hate the word dumb, but, you know, can't speak. So there had to be a karmic tie, we think, from past lives between them in order for there to be communication on other lines and other levels. But then that was brought down into the mundane, and she was not only able to speak and write, she was a great speaker. She, very intelligent woman, very well known. During that time, most people with that condition, they would have been shut away in an institution, and that would have been, they never would have been heard of for that lifetime, at least. In the back?
And she went on to graduate from college. There's an interesting family connection within that whole story. Annie Sullivan was sent to the Keller family by Alexander Graham Bell, who knew about it because he married into the Grosvenor's family, the National Geographic, and they were very supportive of issues for the deaf and the blind. So there's a huge connection of important people working on it. But back to that earlier about karma not being linear, and yet it's linear in a family suffering a particular condition. Well, that's because the tendency that started it did not necessarily come in a linear way. It wasn't until all those members of that family were brought together. So who knows the starting point? But once it starts, yes, it's linear because it has to be worked out or it will continue. So we don't think it disputes the linear aspect of it.
So they're neat. True, it's both. And there needs to be that, you know, the parents give the karmic heirloom, the right soil, as it were, the right nurturing or lack of nurturing for that child's development and experience, and reward or punishment, because in the case of Helen Keller, they had great means. So that was great. They had the karma that they had the means to be able, you know, if they didn't have the means, if they were poor, then that would have been a completely different story. Yes?
Are we given any hints as to...
That's okay. No. Continue.
Are we given any hints as to why it's three lives? Why that is specific?
Not that we're aware of, or we haven't come across that in any of our readings. Do you have an idea?
Well, we don't recall that specifically given, but we think that we can put it together from the aphorisms, because it says there's three fields of karma.
Okay.
Being the mental, the psychic, and the physical.
Right.
And action, as we're taught, begins in the mind, in the mental plane. We're also told that there are diseases on this plane are the working out of karma, and it's last expressing itself on the physical plane. So we can maybe deduce that the reason it's three lives at least is because that karma, which initially began on the moral plane, has to work itself out on the mental, the psychic, and the physical before it's completely out of the system. And it may take longer than that if the effort isn't made or somebody does something in between that extends it.
It's right. It's three lives at least, it says. And when measures of repression, elimination, or counteraction are not adopted... We were wondering if it does take three lives and this works on three planes and the physical is the last, then does that mean that people that are suffering from mental and nervous disorders, that that's the next to last? That the physical is the next, that they can... And we're just putting that out there. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, can we mitigate the karma in the mental state before it got to the physical?
Well, we think that psychiatry and psychology has made some pretty good strides. Of course, there's a lot of, like anything else, there's good and bad. But there certainly are measures that one can take and medications that one can take that can eliminate some of the worst aspects. Yes?
Well, we would think that the best way to mitigate our karma is to read the Bhagavad Gita and try to apply the principles which are dictated there, and our lives begin to unfold in front of us. So, you know, there is a path, and it's shown out to us how to mitigate our karma, but it's through our actions that we mitigate it, through our attitude, through our effort.
And thought. Thought is action, too. Thought is on the plane of action. Someone had their hand up earlier. Yes.
Yeah, the thought occurs with the as we consider linear versus cyclical or circular. In the social sciences, there are exercises for students to go through where they try to find simple, direct cause and effect. A leads to B. But then also there's a practice exercise where they're looking at some event in history when they realize that cause A leads to a result B, which becomes a cause for C, D, whatever. And it's not necessarily linear because there's all these intermittent faculties and intermittent factors that react against one another. So as we consider linear and cyclical across time, we could see both in operation.
Yes, thank you. In the back?
We think it's interesting that in today's world, they say that if you want to create a new habit, you have to establish it for at least 3 weeks before it will take hold. And that's, you know, it all goes back to those three fundamentals. There's the power, and then there's the user of the power, and then there's the substance in which one uses that power. So it all makes perfectly good sense if we can tie it all together.
It does. That's the great thing about this philosophy, is that it's really a guide for living a sane and balanced life. There are many self-help programs, and we're not knocking them because they do a lot of good, but they're kind of rely on an outside power, and that can limit one's own potential. In a sense, it's a crutch. It may be necessary at first, but there comes a point where you need to break out of that and really do serious self-examination and, in a sense, be the captain of your own ship.
We have a very interesting little pamphlet on the book table called Karma and Reincarnation, which are two articles by Mr. Judge. In that article on karma, he says that karma can be exhausted on the mental plane if we focus our attention there and eliminate the defects and faults of our thinking so that we don't have to experience that karma later on the lower planes.
Yes, and we think that the best way of helping ourselves is by helping others. And that's the various fellowships where one is not just concerned with oneself, but really trying to help their fellow suffering companion, as it were, all in the same kind of boat, is great, and it's helping others is the best way to get over oneself.
Oddly enough, isn't that why those of us who are students keep attending all these meetings? It isn't to hear ourselves talk, it's to have the chance to be part of helping others.
Yes, ideally. We're not here to just you know, repeat certain things. But yet we can always learn for ourselves too, because we may not have heard, or like take the Bhagavad Gita for instance. It's written on many levels, and it's the study of adepts. And so if the adepts are still studying the Bhagavad Gita, so they're still coming around, they're still studying. The more you know, the more you know what, how little you know, in a sense. It really is. They say a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing, because it is. It's if you have a little bit of knowledge and you think it's the whole thing, then you're just going to create trouble for yourself and others.
Aphorism 28, the first sentence, no man but a sage or true seer can judge another's karma. Is it possible that we know that the adepts can see into the future? If they perceive that there's going to be something worldwide happening, would somebody's karma, I mean, can they, like, you know, never mind. This can't no, I can't answer my own question.
Well,
and we don't know that it can be answered.
If a sage or a seer saw it was your karma and it was your just deserts, they're not going to interfere. That's a misuse of their power. But like, and it really goes next week. I don't want to go into next week's part, but we'll just mention that, you know, people are not in certain places at certain times because they've either been warned or had a feeling to get out of there, and then they're safe. So there's many ways to be warned, but that's actually next week's part. Yes?
Continue on 28. So we were wondering, when exactly is this choice made that leads one into difficult circumstances? Is it made during life? Is it made before we were born? Is it part of the moment of choice? When is that choice made that leads to that kind of difficult life?
Well, we're all given a sketch of the life to be lived before each incarnation. It's not the same as the review, the afterlife review. It's very, very detailed. But there's enough detail for one to realize that it is just and that it is due. Now, when this is, we really couldn't say when. We think that there's a, it could be in the present moment. There's a resolution or a vow or a pledge someone makes to one's higher self that one really wants to work for the good of all, that in a sense then you're volunteering yourself for some difficult times, but that's what you want, that's how you learn, that's how you can help others through the experience. You know, we've all known people who, you know, they preach one thing, but they live another way, and that's because they may be ignorant of the fact, they may not be doing it on purpose. But did you have a follow up or?
Well, just quickly said that, so that voluntary pledge or determination to be willing to face whatever suffering in order to strengthen oneself and help others, is that the real basis of the doctrine of vicarious atonement? Is that the real meaning of it, as opposed to the way it's?
It could be. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Vicarious atonement is generally thought that a savior, Jesus, for example, although there were many other saviors before him, died on the cross for our sins, but it's the cross of matter. It's really allegorical. It's not meant to be taken literally, but people take it literally and think that somebody else already did the work. The debt has already been paid. All I need to do is believe, and I am saved. But we could be doing vicarious atonement for others ourselves, and they could see by our example, because example is the greatest teacher, much more so than words. So we can see someone in dire straits who is just full of love and compassion and acceptance, and then, in a sense, others could vicariously learn that lesson, we suppose, in that sort of situation. In the back?
Going back to the vow or a pledge, it couldn't be made just once. You think it would have to be part of the consciousness of that soul most of the time, and certainly they'd have to renew it every life in order to hold on to that.
Okay, well, there has to be made once at one time. There's a first time for everything. So, but yeah, it's something that's why we have the Kuan Yin pledge, which we used to have up here. But it's never will I
receive
salvation for my own personal benefit. That's always for the good of all. Yes.
The example of the first responder just came to mind, where, ultimately speaking, in perhaps a final act, you have a selfless, intuitive reaction to a circumstance, and one soul rushes in to assist, save others, with no consideration to personal cost. A result. But that soul working through that physical has led at least one life, if not many, 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 in which the training needed for the kind of adrenaline rush and the physical strength and the practiced thought pattern of the good of all and doing service, all of that is cumulative. So again, it's cyclical and complex causation as well as linear, isn't it?
Sure, and it's like a musician. They start out practicing, they annoy the neighbors, but if they continue, they can at least make some decent sounds, and if they go further with it, and it's their karma, and they put in all the work, they can become they can spread great joy and yes.
Previously, a contribution was made about studying the Bhagavad Gita, and we think if we look at that first chapter, we see an example of what we're talking about. Arjuna makes the decision in that life to retain his kingdom, calls upon Krishna as his higher self to assist him, and faces all these struggles within and without as a result of that choice. So we can see that the choice itself made in this life is the one that initiates the reaction from life around us. Some of it's our own karma from the past, and some of it's just the karma of the nation and race we're born in.
Right, so we have our own personal, our family, our race, our nation, karma. And karma is a very mysterious doctrine. We can see the effects, but we don't see the cause. And only great sages and adepts can actually see the cause. But we have to work under an assumption that we had something to do with. If it's coming to us, we had something to do with its creation. And that's, we think, is a good premise to operate under. Yes?
So a lot of it seems to me, as far as karma and action and ego in general, is intentions. Because you can say you're altruistic and you're doing all these things to help people, but if you're doing it to be popular or for the wrong reasons, it's all for naught, basically. Or it's not you're not going further on the path. So that's where I find it. It's all about intentions. I mean, I've worked, well, anyway, but I've seen places where people work helping the poor, but a lot of it is ego-driven, and that's what they're about, like just being powerful. And so the intention is slipping away from that. Am I right?
Good. Well, we think so. We can always put this out for discussion, but if we're doing it to look good, then that's an impediment. And certainly, I'm not saying that no good is accomplished, but that's a character fault, and that can be on its way to flowering into a megalomaniac, perhaps in a future incarnation. It could be on its way if it's not mitigated. So that's what we talk about. You know, it says three times, three lives at least, but when measures of repression, elimination, or counteraction are not adopted. However, if the person is doing it out of this, if they're getting an endorphin rush and a high out of looking good to others, then in a sense, they're probably blinded to that for this lifetime. Unless perhaps somebody can point it out to them, you know, if there's somebody that can point it out to them in the right way, and you know, that's the difficulty. That's, you know, but it can, there are people out there that can do that. They may not be your friends, but they may say that just the right thing at the right time. Come back.
You said, you know, some good may be done in spite of it. Well, absolutely. Let's say you're feeding the poor. The poor are getting fed. The problem is you are getting more entrenched on a selfish motive. And we're told that what's in our heart is more important than what's in our mind and what's in our actions. So intention is everything. We just wish that once in a while karma had an intention to send us like a postcard. You know, like, keep up the good work. Or, gee, at last you caught on. And something like that. But we do think that it has come to us through the people around us, whether they're friends or not.
Well, postcards are maybe an email. I don't know. Go ahead.
One of the aphorisms talks about the fields. We know that, you know, moral intention is a creative field, and then there's mental, psychic, and physical. When we think of mundane emotions, everyday emotions, are they part of the psychic nature? Do they also belong to the physical? Are they mental? Where in the world does that kind of thing belong?
Well, that's an interesting point. We, off the top of my head here, I would say all three, but the mundane, what we call mundane is the, Mr. Judge had an expression, the daily jog trot of living. And we can get in this pattern, and we can get deeper and deeper into it, and it can become thoughtless. And it can happen in any career, from the lowest up to professions, we think. One can get entrenched in a certain way. So the mundane, we should try to counteract the mundane. What's coming to us is our karma on a regular basis. But if it becomes too mundane, then it becomes boring, and then it becomes irritating and frustrating. And often we may do something and act out, and then it'll have unintended consequences, which could be, well, unintended consequences. We'll just leave it at that. Yes?
An older student who was previous generations who passed away wrote a very well-known article about how the deepest lessons or occult lessons are learned in the mundane experiences of life, if we know how to approach them. So our karma, what the karmic experience means to us, whether the approach is good, bad, or indifferent karma, depends on the wisdom and the attitude we bring to it.
Right.
It may be the best thing for us, and on the other hand, the most difficult karma could come in sheep's clothing, so to speak.
Right. A wolf in sheep's clothing. That's true. It can come out of nowhere. So we need to be vigilant. We need to look at... We need to always be aware and alive as much as we can and focused on what we do instead of... You know, there are so many distractions nowadays. There's more than ever, but that just means that we need to... Just try to stay focused. In the back.
We really don't understand how anything could be mundane. I mean, if you're going to tie your shoes, who thought of a shoelace? And who was smart enough to make it so the end doesn't fray and makes it easy to pull through? I mean, everything we do from the ground we stand on is incredible. So how can anybody be bored by it?
Well, we don't know, but people certainly are.
Because they're not looking. Yeah. They're looking for something else.
That's true. Well, we can become desensitized to almost anything. We just come to expect it, like it's our right. We're entitled, and then. The more money and power and privilege one has, the more easy it is to fall into that trap. So there's so many traps, but nothing is permanent. That will change. Those people in those positions, they will fall from their high estates. So it's better to be humble now when we're just lowly workers here.
You can't fall
if you're already low. Right, that's true. Yes.
I think sometimes synergy could be perceived as postcards.
Okay. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Take it for what it is.
Well, if we're taking a literal postcard, it's...
I remember reading in the oceans, there are no coincidences. So you take... I mean, I was very struck by could you elaborate? I mean, can that be taken literally? There are no coincidences.
There are no coincidences. Well, we think it can be taken literally, but since we don't know the source, it's very hard to give examples. Does anyone? Yes.
Sometimes in life, you hear somebody say, the universe is speaking, and then they go on to chit-chat about how they were perplexed by a problem, and then they heard something on the radio, and then they found something in an article, and then a friend mentioned something.
Right.
And all of these pieces are bringing either the same or similar information to answer or to clarify what perplexed the person to begin with. So that kind of serendipity that looks like coincidence,
right?
The people say the universe is speaking, may be an example.
So some may call that luck, but it's more than just luck. When we see a linear thread there, we can actually see something linear happening that's pointing us, if we're aware, if we're sober and alert and focused, then we can read the signs. Yes.
Do So maybe then, rather than looking at the word coincidence, as most of us probably do, as you know, some kind of a lucky thing that happened, oh, it's a coincidence, just look at those two signs coming together. Well, they coincide, don't they? But
yeah.
If something coincides, we don't think that that's luck necessarily. It's more that they're working together.
Right. So things may run parallel for quite a while, but they're on kind of a slight angle. And it may seem linear, but then they come together and they form a point or a focus. And then there's a, yes.
Maybe an example of that is in healthcare, we think years ago we used to hear doctors talk about more about this issue causes that problem, and we talk about cause and effect. But mostly now, when we've been with healthcare professionals, we hear the words is associated with much, much more than this causes that. We hear this is associated with that. And it's an interesting difference. And so in that sense, there are certain symptoms and problems and issues that coincide. And almost like from within the being, things are starting to happen. But whether you can actually put your hand on it in a physical way and definitely show that this causes that is a completely different, we think, world today than it was years ago. It's less materialistic in that sense.
Yeah, science is becoming less and less materialistic. And also, you know, we're cautioned about taking care of our bodies, taking good care of them, and that will mitigate a lot of things. We may still get disease because it is the last manifestation of the karma, but we should try not to exacerbate things. Yes?
Well, should we really care what's going to happen? Because, in fact, it's just going to happen. We would think that our only responsibility is to be awake when it happens, that we are as conscious as possible so that we can control our reaction, so that we can work with it rather than fighting like I shouldn't be getting this, or why is this coming, you know, just accept it and just move on and not make an issue. Or not look into the future or predict what kind of karma it's going to happen.
Well, an example is given of somebody who's born lame or crippled, or they have they're deformed in some way. If they accept it and are happy, then it's moving out. But if they're always fighting against it, and they're resentful, and they're angry, or they're jealous, or they're saying, why me, why me, why me, all the time. You know, we always have at least two choices, always.
Going back to the synergy specifically, the book that we need to read would have fallen at our feet. The friend who would say something, all of these things would happen, but if we weren't asking the question and paying attention, we would never see that synergy. So the two have to work together. We have to be ready for it, because it happens all the time. We just don't recognize it.
Right. Well, the expression that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And the teacher may be just in coming in contact with something that's, you know, enlightening, like theosophy, or it could be an actual person. And there are many teachers. It may not be one teacher. There is a guru parampara chain, but the philosophy is put forth for us to ready ourselves for that point when we're actually getting direct instruction. But this is all impacted in our inner nature. All this knowledge is actually within us. It just needs to be brought out. But then we need people, in a sense, to bring it out of us. Yes?
we remember one of our professors using the term, the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Right.
So maybe that's part of the lesson, that if we're going along fine, doing the best we can, even in difficult circumstances, we don't need karma, post-karma. It's the one that's failed, that's slipping behind, that needs the karmic bump, or the reminder, or the encouragement. Not just from quote karma, but from their human companions as well.
Yes. This gentleman, yes. The man in the sweater who's yawning? No? Okay, sorry. I thought you had your hand up.
How about the use of the term, the practice is more important than the thing done?
The practice is more important than the thing done. Well, what is it process-oriented or results-oriented? What do we think about that?
Yes. I don't understand the quote.
The practice, well, the quote is, okay, the practice is more important than the thing done.
So if I write that the quote perfectly, is that the practice? I don't understand.
If you rob a bank perfectly. Well, now that's the thing done. That's not the practice. The practice is the practice is casing the joint. Go ahead.
The practice is staying focused in class and doing your homework and studying for the test. When you get into the test, if you blow it, you blow it. But if you've done the work for the test, then you've built certain skills regardless of whether that's reflected in the test.
So we're always practicing because there are always lessons to be learned. And when a thing is done, in a sense, it's done and over with, and then we shouldn't be dwelling on how wonderful a person we are to have accomplished that. We should be moving on to something else. Because then we're focused on the past, and then the whole ego thing gets involved again. Yes?
I was going to say, isn't that kind of like karma? It's like doing what your duty, but not looking for the reward. It's just doing what needs to be done.
Ideally, yes. Yes.
And the renunciation of the fruits of one's action.
Exactly. We need to really be, that's another lesson, to really renunciate the fruits of one's action. All these things will help us stay in balance, and then to see other opportunities to serve. Yes?
Throw every deed on me alone. Thus, when that is done, the rise above all come.
Could you repeat that in a little bit louder, please?
Throw every deed on me.
Okay. Well, we have come to the end of the hour here. We have one more week with these wonderful aphorisms, and they are certainly very thought-provoking. And so, meeting is adjourned.